There's a particular morning routine that I would like to make reference to today. And I'll tell you why in just a moment. The morning routine is 5:45 a.m. We come in to sit zazen. The bell rings after the first offering is made. And then we sit together, breathe together for 40 minutes. The bell rings again. And the next thing that happens is what we call the road chant, in which people who have sewn robes put the robe on their head and do the road chant and then put it on for the first time of the day. So then we move into service, which is bowing and chanting. That set of bows, here's how I feel it. There's no doctrine that says this is true, but this is how I feel it. That set of 9 bows in the morning, 3 bows in the evening, kind of prepares me to humbly hear the teaching that we're about to recite. You know, get ourselves even closer to the earth than we were in our zazen posture, and humbly prepare ourselves to receive the teaching. And then during service, we chant them, recite them. And these are the teachings that come down to us over hundreds of years. That's the sequence. And being human, it shouldn't surprise us that we have ritual, you know, routines or rituals. And in this setting, the rituals are marked very frequently with bell. Even if you're not in the zendo, in the morning, I bet you have a routine or a ritual that you do. If you're a coffee drinker, you probably have a very specific way that you set your cup down, that you prepare your water, you know. That is as much a ritual as anything else. Even animals have rituals. My dog has a particular way of behaving when at different times of the day. I'm a very routine-oriented person, and she's a very routine-oriented dog. It's probably a mutually influencing routine. But we all have something like that, that we could easily call ritual. Just one thing follows another in a quite obvious and seamless way. I have to detour. Even animals have ritual. Recently I've observed the goats across the street from us. And did anybody, when you were little, play this game called King of the Mountain, Queen of the Mountain? You basically have a mound of anything. It could be dirt, leaves, anything. Pitcher's mound, anything. And the game is to be the one who gets to stand on top for a little while, and everybody else's game is to shove you off. So it's basically a good excuse to tumble around. So these goats across the street have a morning ritual. One of the goats is black and white, the other goat is brown. And they seem to have a preference for playing King of the Mountain or Queen of the Mountain. And they, every morning, get up to the top of this little set of tables that they have and playfully butt each other until one falls off. And then whoever won gets to have that spot for the whole rest of the day. And the one who didn't win gets the next table down. And then next morning, they do the same thing, and they seem to have this agreement that whoever wins gets the top for the day. And next day, new game, the whole thing starts all over again.
How variable is that? Between who wins? Is it one dominant or is it pretty?
Well, in my observation so far, it seems to be pretty equal. And that might be part of their agreement, I don't know. But even the goats have ritual. Sorry for the detour, I couldn't not think of animals and routines, sorry. So the reason I wanted to talk about ritual and routine is, at least in part, for Nanette, our dear friend, many of you know, who lives now in Santa Fe with Chuck. And they are very active participants in Upaya Zen Center, where Roshi Joan Halifax is the leader. And at this time, Nanette is head student there, Shizo. And the case that she has chosen to study is this one. It is Yunmen, and it's called The Sound of the Bell. It's the case 16 of Mumonkong. Yunmen said, "See how vast and wide the world is. Why do you put on your seven-piece robe at the sound of the bell?" She has become intimate with this particular inquiry. Of course, you know that there's no one answer to that, but I thought we could explore this together, and I'll send her a recording of this conversation, help her along in her studies as she so. So the world is, in fact, vast and wide. So the implication, in a way, in some very superficial way, the implication of this question is, if there are so many other interesting things to do, why would you sit down for Zazen? Why would you put on your robe at the sound of the bell? So this is not unlike the sentence from Suzuki through Catherine to us last week. What we're talking about here is the practice of practice rather than the idea of practice. Putting on one's robe is engaging actively with the practice. And I recognize that speaking only of the robe has the potential to alienate those who are not currently wearing a robe. So please understand, this is not about the robe. This is not about the bell. These two words, or these two objects, are simply symbolic of our wish to return to stability. This is really about the core teachings that throughout the centuries have come down to us, influenced by several cultures through which this practice has passed, and even today influenced by our own individual family and personal cultures, as well as our broader, what we would call Western world. But very specifically, this question of why would we sit down for Zazen, why would we do such a thing as putting on a robe, is an example of what the ancestors have been telling us for years. It is required that we personally engage with practice. And putting on a robe is symbolic of that. The bells of the temple are simply a way of marking time. And responding to the bell is simply a way of saying, I agree to hold this schedule. When the bell rings, I will maintain my silence. I will minimize my physical activity for the benefit of those near me. And I will stay put for this period of time. When we're saying, I will stay put for this period of time, what we're saying is, I'm responding to the invitation to step out of a normal, habitual life that might be dominated by reactivity or dominated by impulses, habitual impulses. And for at least this 40 minutes of Zazen, I'm turning toward making conscious choices. And we do this during Zazen in a super simple way. All we have to do is breathe. I think I've said before here, we've got this scientific experiment going on, basically, in which we eliminate all variables except breathing. And for those who remember to keep their eyes open and blinking. So we've eliminated most variables, and then it becomes obvious that everything else that's going on internally, the internal storms that are occurring, I know I have my own, are extra. I've added them to this moment of breathing and blinking. And breathing and blinking next to my companions, my Dharma friends. What we're doing by sitting down, by responding to the bell, is saying, yes, for this period of time, I'm going to stay put and investigate whatever arises. This all by itself creates the stability to be able to, when we become just a little bit more active, as we did this evening, we move out of the simple activity of breathing and blinking and into something quite a bit more complex, walking. Now, how shall I respond to the world? My task is to stay equidistant from the people before me and behind me. So the task has become a little bit more complex. Now this body in relationship to every other body in the room, so on. Eventually what we're doing is taking this developing capacity to stay stable out into our lives, so that when it becomes really complex, we know how to come back to center and respond from a conscious place rather than from the habitual. I would say that everything we're doing in this room, Zazen, service, bowing, putting on robes, whatever we're doing, is in service of being able to stay grounded in the face of super complex activity. It's training. I'll say something about bowing. You know, it's courtesy when we're seated in Zazen, generally facing the wall, and someone arrives to the seat next to us. It's a courtesy when they bow to their seat to bow with them. That's a way of saying, I see you, welcome. Let's breathe together. You know, it's like saying good morning or good evening. And then similarly, when we end, we bow to the cushion, thank you, cushion, for holding me up for these 40 minutes, and bow to the room. Now I'm ready to re-enter public life. And, for example, if it is Scott who has bowed to his cushion and now to the room, Saeed, who's directly across from him, would bow. Just a courtesy, because we wouldn't ignore someone's bow. And then, because next to Saeed are Michael and Charlie, they also would bow with Scott, because they're kind of in the same general face-on-face field. So it is one on one side with three on the other. Uh-huh. There's been a little confusion about what is that bow supposed to be. Anyway, that gives you a little hint. And more than anything, it is common courtesy when someone is bowing in your direction to return that bow. So these tiny details, there's nothing magic about them. There's nothing even special about them. They're simply ways of occupying the same space with some agreement about how we'll behave. And this agreement about how we'll behave contributes to allowing ourselves and each other to become stable. minimize distractions so that we can actually be fully where we are. Present moment awareness, fully where we are. It's not a small part that we come to the Zendo to sit with each other. You know, if I wanted to just sit in my own stew, I could sit at home. But I come to sit with you. You know, this is about Dharma friendship. It's quiet, you know, in some funny way, very intimate to spend all of this quiet time together. It's about community. And when we engage such a thing as putting on a robe at the sound of the bell, we're saying, not only have I come to enjoy the discipline of holding the schedule, I've come to enjoy the discipline of holding the schedule with you. And in the case of those who are wearing robes, you've made a public statement, we've made a public statement that this is my practice. So not only with the other people in the room, but other people throughout space and time. I would like to say a little something about the robes in case you're curious. You may know that I teach the sewing of this kind of robe. It's very, very formulaic. It's rigidly held and has been held this way for several hundred years. Here's the story as I've heard it. In case you have not, I want to share it with you. There was a time at the time of the Buddha when another esteemed person in the community, in some versions this is a king or a landowner, had the habit of getting off his carriage and bowing to, like full bows, all the way down to the earth, bowing to the disciples of the Buddha in appreciation for what the Buddha was teaching, the community that they were building. And at some point in that time, the story is told, that important person bowed to someone who wasn't one of Buddha's disciples. And so he scolded the Buddha and said, you have to find a way to identify who are your people. And so Buddha took up the task with his half-brother, cousin Ananda, and they designed a robe based on using little bits and pieces of cast-off cloth that they cleaned, cast-off cloth from places where people had had their cremation ceremony, or where people had toileted or cleaned their bodies. They cleaned all of that cloth, dyed it one color, and sewed it together. They decided to sew it together, Ananda and the Buddha, making this pattern based on their observations of how rice fields are. And if you look at it real closely, you'll see that there are these great wide panels, that is the field itself, and then places in between where the farmer might walk. These are sewn together in the form of rice fields. When we chant the robe chant, this is, in English, we say the field far beyond form and emptiness. In some translation, which Shohaku Kumura says is a little bit more accurate translation, this is the rice field of benevolence, or the virtuous and boundless rice field. It's another way of thinking of it. Even in that short robe chant, the robe has three names. Robe of liberation, this benevolent rice field, and the teaching of the Tathagata. It has all three names right there in the robe chant. Why would we choose to take this up? And please know that I'm not speaking now only about the robe, but why would we take up this practice of intending liberation or abiding in a field of benevolence or taking up these teachings at all? I would assert that we take these up because we know that it's intuitively correct. We somehow know in our guts, even without knowing it in our minds necessarily, cognitively, we know in our guts, we have an intuition that living this way in a field of benevolence or understanding the truth of what the Buddha taught is intuitively correct, seems true. There's this other aspect of why would we put on the robe at the sound of the bell? The bell is just functioning as a bell. It doesn't strike itself. It requires an interaction in order to fulfill its function. In order for the bell to sound, it requires interaction with someone or something that will invite out its sound. The way Catherine taught the skill of ringing these bells is not to strike it, but rather to invite its sound. It's a very beautiful way of saying this instrument in interaction with my body, the other instrument, we co-create this sound. So the bell is simply fulfilling its function as a bell, calling out in a bellish sort of a way, and you respond or you don't. You know, that part is yours internally to do. It is not that one way is better or not better than the other. You just observe your response. This thing happens. And how do you respond? That's the entire task. That's the entire training of Zazen. That's exactly what we're doing in life. This thing happens. What is the appropriate response? How do I meet this set of conditions completely? In the real chant, wherein the Tathagata's teaching, what's hiding inside that sentence is beginning to understand the teaching of impermanence and the teaching of interconnection. Those two things kind of form the basis, right? You've heard that many times. It's actually helpful to be reminded of this, I feel, on a daily basis. So the discipline of returning to the Zendo again and again, to listen to the bell, to sit with each other, is a way of recalling this, or reactivating this on a daily basis. It's so easy to forget, it's so easy to get pulled off in one direction or another. Why would we do this at the sound of the bell? In order to recall our deepest intuition. There is something at the end of the case, in the more common, that is this, there are always capping verses at the ends of these studies. Here's the verse. With realization, all things are one family. Without realizations, all things are disconnected. There's kind of logic in that, but then it gets turned upside down. Listen to the second part. Without realizations, all things are one family. With realization, all things are disconnected.
Yes.
Handing it to us in one way and then taking it apart the other way. What's consistent is all things are one family and all things are disconnected. Without the presence or absence of realization has nothing to do with all things being one family. The presence or absence of realization has nothing to do with things being disconnected. In some ways, that's another way of talking about form and emptiness. This form and emptiness comes back in so many forms, so many ways in the teachings. It doesn't matter, honestly, whether there's realization when you come to sit zazen. The endeavor is all about returning. So what if you have realized something? New day, new bell, put on the new recalling what we know to be true, intuitively correct. The world is vast and wide. Why do you put on your robe at the sound of the bell? Why do you return? And then one more thing, and then I'll ask you, why do you come here? Why have you come, as the movie, famous phrase of the movie, why have you come? But this one thing, before conversation, the bell rings, we sit down, we do this maybe even counterintuitive practice. The bell rings again, and then we get up. And we take the robe off. That's the part that's not spoken in this koan. Put the robe on, take the robe off, and then what happens? This is an example now of Dogen's teaching. Zazen is not limited to sitting or lying down. Right? During all one's waking hours, we hear in a different chant, during all one's waking hours, let one practice the way with gratitude. Not holding to fixed views, endowed with insight, freed from the constraints of habitual, let one practice the way with gratitude. Right. Not limited to sitting or lying down. Because we put on the robe at the sound of the bell, because we sit down and do this practice called zazen, we also have to take the robe off and get up and go engage with our life. So, why have you come? It's different things for different people at different times, right? And different things for different people at different times of our own lives. For me, 30 years ago it was one thing, now it's something else. And that changes as our lives change. But for tonight, why have you come? Yes.
I think you put it perfectly. I don't believe I need to answer. We're here, so.
Might as well.
What the heck? Just like, to me, just like the choice of being born, deciding to train and see what we can make of this life. Mm-hmm. So I come to train and see what I can make of this life.
Mm-hmm. Can you give an example of how the training of returning influences your life.
You used the word returning to stability.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that spoke. That's why I really don't think I have to say anything, but some of the things you said, but returning to stability and seeing if that can become inhabited into the rest of the way I live.
Mm-hmm.
One thought is my thought of certain renunciates who I would consider Zen or Buddhists might not take their robes on and off.
Mm-hmm.
They just wear their patch robes all the time and go beg with their bowl and live their life.
Right.
That's a possibility in my mind.
Yes. And there are people who do that. And here we are in a lay-based practice center engaged in the exact same practice.
Right.
Yeah.
Because our lives are, we're not quite renunciates. We don't beg and do that way.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful, beautiful picture, image to me, though.
Yes. Yeah. So for you, the training of making the stable, the habitual, is part of what your intention is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you. And thank you.
Definitely, I come here to continue learning how to find that stability and present awareness in my body. So an example is on Monday evening, I'm usually here as Dawn on Tuesday morning, and Monday evening I was just feeling listening and feeling tired, and like that's what I need to be paying attention to. So I text or emailed Edie and said, I can't come tomorrow. I need to just not. But then at 8:20 that same evening, I got a call from my dear neighbor who's 85. I fell, I need you. At which point, that was another thing that surfaced. So that awareness to be able to go, take her to the, you know, eventually to Dominican and be there till 1 o'clock in the morning. I don't think I could have done all of that. Even though I already thought I was just in one place, another thing happened that drew me into that place, and that ability to kind of be that stability in the midst of something else is this practice.
Yes. Yes. So you thought it was going to be one way.
Yeah.
And something else happened.
Yeah.
And you found an appropriate response.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's the fruit of Zazen for me.
Exactly. Thank you. Thank you for that example. So what we're doing and what you've both now expressed is turning toward the present moment with full awareness rather than being caught up in trying to be somewhere else or someone else. Right? Or in its very basic, I'm present to the mind and heart that's trying to be somewhere else. Right?
Would you say I'm present?
I am present to the mind that is trying very hard to make this be some other way as part of the conditions of this moment. Yeah. So responding to all of the conditions, even the conditions that I, for example, would like to turn away from. It's humbling to admit, yeah, I really do want this to be some other way. But there it is. It's true. So own that first, and now I can respond to the actual moment. Mm-hmm. Yes, Rick.
I'm practicing not picking and choosing. Taking a vacation from picking and choosing.
And we would expect a vacation to create some lightheartedness, some ease. Is that working?
In a way.
Yes. Uh-huh. A real vacation.
It's kind of a relief. Yeah.
A relief, yes. There are two ways of asking that question. Forgive me. one way, and I genuinely meant, is that working? And there's another snarky way to say, how's that working for you? You know, assuming that it's not.
So
in this conversation, I genuinely meant, how is that? You know, is there relief? Is there a vacation?
Well, there's resistance too, of course.
Say more about that.
I mean, you know, I spent my whole life picking and choosing, but I have to say it hasn't worked out too well on the whole, or in many instances. And there's something that's more important, or there's something which I could call my deepest intention that is more important to me than my preferences.
Yes.
So I know that I need to be willing to set aside my preferences, or what I'm calling my picking and choosing, in order to realize that deepest intention. So, you know, I'm finding, in spite of whatever discomfort or resistance, I'm willing to set aside my preferences.
Yes.
And as I say, there's a kind of freedom, a kind of relief.
Yes.
In doing that.
Very clear, Rick. Thank you. Taking a vacation from picking and choosing. Very, very clear. Thank you. And Shakti, yes.
Why am I here? Because it's on my schedule.
Uh-huh.
And but as it kind of fits into what you were saying, it's ritual. I come here because this is what I do. I listen to the Dharma talk because I want to become more rich. And I was so touched what the gentleman here was saying, because that I wish that I had done this practice from when I was a teenager, younger, because there's so many times in life where you have a decision to make, and I think this practice is really helpful for decision making.
Yeah.
You know, it helps to put space and to see things more clearly.
Yes, exactly so. So this taking a vacation from picking and choosing is exactly what allows us to get a clear view rather than an encumbered or a clouded view. Then the choice is obvious. Once we're clear of our values and the view is unclouded, the appropriate response arises all by itself. We could say this is an example of compassion expressing compassion. We're not in the way. The way things are is simply expressing itself. This is now, thank you, Chappie, that is exactly what this capping verse is about. All things are one family, all things are disconnected. With or without realization, it doesn't matter. It just, that's what's on the schedule. That's what we're doing. You know, there are many times, and then I'll stop, we're close to ending. There are many times when I would be able to reflect quietly. If I could talk to my younger self, what would I be telling my younger self now? Right? Well, how about if I tell my existing self that? I don't have to go back in time. I can start now. It's cool. Present moment awareness. To this set of conditions as they unfold. Very good. Thank you very much for engaging this. And all of our best wishes to Nanette in her closing ceremony.